No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
To Shadow Politics. That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People the Right to Vote.
You sound different, Michael.
I do?
Yeah. You've always did the introduction the same measured way, and today you're sounding like you got a little bit of a lift in your foot or step or what have you.
Well, I just came back from Chinese New Year, so maybe that's it. But I want to welcome everybody to Shallow Politics, which is an hour-long grassroots talk show, which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. See, I'm back on track now. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony, along with my brilliant co-host and beautiful co-host, Maria Sanchez. We hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So come on in and join in the discussion by calling in at 888-627-6008, or you can Skype us your comments at BBSRADIO and the number one. Thanks for being here, Maria.
Michael, welcome. You know what? When I say, when people don't know about Shadow Politics, which is getting to be not the norm, I have to say, our program, for some reason, and thankfully so to the listeners, is getting traction now.
Yeah.
And I'll say, so they go, oh, well, who's your program with? And I said, oh, well, he's United States Senator Michael D. Brown. And they go, oh, where is he from? I said, the District of Columbia. And everybody does this. Their eyes dart back and forth. Their brain is trying to unscramble what I've just said. And then they go, huh? And I go, I know. It sounds like an oxymoron, right? Because how can you have a senator from the District of Columbia? But you must be proud of President Trump's presidential limousine.
Well, I mean, I went and I said something nice about him. I put on Facebook that I thanked him on Facebook for putting the tags. For those of you that don't know,
and you can Google it and see it in living color,
or you can come to my Facebook page and you'll see it. I put it up.
There you go.
But you know what? We have in the district, for those of you that don't know, we elect two United States senators and a United States representative. None of us has a vote in Congress. We have no control over our budget. We have no control over our legal system. So we have license plates that say taxation without representation. And we tried to get President Clinton was the first person, first president, to put these tags on his car. And then President Bush took them off the car and refused to put them on. Then President Obama didn't put them on for the first term, his first term. And after we bugged him a lot about it and sent two people to the White House, actually, he put them on in his second term. But President Trump went to Philadelphia to talk to Republicans this week.
Last week, right.
Yeah, and on the presidential limo, which has some cute name that I can't remember, like the dinosaur, the, you know, something. It's a big, heavy limo. Anyway, he put the no taxation without representation.
Well, it says taxation without representation.
Right.
But I have to correct you that President Clinton didn't put it on until his last weeks of his presidency. So you have to be proud that President Trump did it in the first week of his presidency.
Well, and just to be absolutely clear about President Clinton, during his first term as president, we didn't have those license plates. We only came up with the slogan during the middle of his presidency. So he did. He put him on the last in the very last weeks of his presidency. But just to be fair, he probably had the other DC license plates on that didn't say that prior to that. But yeah, we're you know what? It's an important symbol to recognize what our situation.
And he's doing it right away. I ran into a neighbor of mine who is in the entertainment industry here in Hollywood, and he happens to be a Republican. And I was like, I can't even believe that we haven't even had a conversation in the last 6 months, because he and I are very much in alignment in how we view the world. And he was like, dang, the guy is just barreling through like a bull in a china shop, and he is taking no prisoners. And I think he's working 7 days a week.
Well, he may be doing that, but he's getting himself in a lot of trouble around here in D.C., let me tell you. And I started out my Facebook page this week with starting a conversation, which has grown over the week. We've gotten some 175 people involved in a couple of Facebook things this week. And that's what I started out by saying. I started out by saying that I'm not happy with what's going on, but we need to find common ground. And I told the story, and here's another positive story to tell, about a bunch of Republicans that came for the Trump inauguration. And they went to a local restaurant. You may not have heard this out in L.A., but it was on the news here in Washington a lot. They went to a local restaurant called Busboys and Poets, and they met a young black waitress who served them and evidently was very polite to them. And when they left her a note. And the note, let me see if I can find what it said. It said, "We may come from different cultures and may disagree on certain issues, but if everyone would share their smile and kindness like your beautiful smile, our country will come together as one people, not race, not gender, just Americans. God bless." Oh. And on top of that, they left on their 72 check a $450 tip.
You're kidding.
No, I think that's more than 15%. I haven't worked it out, but yes, they left her.
I mean, 150%
tip, and of course, you know, it turned out that this woman, who is a professional dancer works as a waitress to supplement her income, as the father of two dancers, I can tell you they don't make a lot of money. She was overwhelmed because she had just moved and didn't have the money to pay some of the upfront costs of moving. You know, you always have to put down a deposit and other stuff. So the $450 couldn't have come to her at a better time. So I said, look, I don't believe in the wall. I don't believe in some of the other stuff that's going on, which I hope you and I will discuss tonight.
The law, did you say? I don't believe in the law.
No, I'm sorry, in the wall. W-A-L.
In the wall. Okay.
Right. But if there are Republicans out there that are willing to reach out, let's get some Democrats and liberals out there willing to reach out, and maybe we can come together and find some common ground. And you know what I found out through and as we go through the show, maybe I'll read some of these. Some of them were not positive. They were like, you know, we hate this man and we have to stop him, or you know, you liberals always say the same stupid crap, you know, whatever. But most of the responses, I have to tell you, were, yes, we need to come together to move the country forward. And I think that's a very positive sign.
Well, honestly, Michael, if someone is a rational human being, why wouldn't they echo that sentiment?
Well, because they're so hurt right now. But yes,
get over it.
Absolutely.
For goodness sakes.
If we,
it's been almost 3 months.
If we have to go forward, if our modus operandi and moving forward is for us to stand in each other's way, then we're not going to get anywhere.
Right.
But let me tell you, I'm not sure the people inside the Trump administration are hearing this, because they're moving ahead like steamrollers, like a bull in a china shop, and they've done some stuff this week that's just, when was the last time, Maria, you saw a president come into office that had this kind of reaction with these protests and other things that have been going on this week? Today,
well, he's polarizing. Yes. There's no doubt about it. There's hardly anybody that is in the middle with their feelings about him. And polarizing is unpopular and popular. You either are or you aren't. Nearly everybody has some kind of opinion. And I don't think that that's wrong either or bad, because there's somebody who actually is finally standing up and saying things that are politically incorrect, unpopular, perhaps going against the norm or the way we've done business before. And we'll find out. There's going to either be results or they won't. In other words, he's either going to prosper or flop. Well, if the stock market is any indication.
Well, and you know what? Maybe, and just maybe, what's going to happen is it's going to bring everybody out and start a national discussion. And let's hope it doesn't digress ultimately into a screaming match. I mean, right now it may be a screaming match, but let's hope at some point that it does start a constructive dialogue and
conversation. We keep saying this, that we're the perfect case in point. You and I disagree, and we do so respectfully and intelligently. And there's nothing wrong with disagreements. If you've surrounded yourself with sycophants that all we followed along with you lock and step, how boring would that be?
Well,
and how uninformed would one be?
Absolutely. And, you know, like I said on the last show, you really can't learn anything new from somebody that agrees with you. You can only learn new things by having controversy. And that's what Kennedy, you know, he used to pride himself on, trying to get people in a room that disagreed with each other and sit back and listen. So you know, smart people in a room that disagree with each other and, sit back and listen and try to figure out what the best approach was by listening to both sides. And you're absolutely right, Maria. That's exactly what we're trying to do. Unfortunately for you and I, we just found out that neither one of us is as smart as Doug, but I think we can both
speaking
accept
about
that.
Our engineer and owner,
and then we can move forward. So
yes,
but yes, absolutely. We're you know, that's really what we need to do. But what a week! What a week! I mean, you know, and you've
where
got
do we
people.
Start?
Right. Well, first of all, I'd like to say that I'm not sure that the president-elect understands.
You mean the president?
I'm sorry, the president. Isn't that terrible? I'm still saying president-elect.
Yes.
You know, that the president understands that half of America's against him. I mean, half of America may be for him. We don't know approximately, right? But half of them's against him because he's not making any friends out there this week. I'll tell you that.
Well, and as I said, he's either going to prosper or he's going to flop, because he's taking some very decisive and firm positions, and he's not straddling both sides of the world. Probably we should talk about the ban, right?
Yeah, I mean,
so
look,
that
that's
was
what's
Friday,
going on, right? Right.
Radical Islamic terrorists, 90-day ban.
On
Iraq, Syria, Iran, Sudan, Libya, Somalia, Yemen.
Right. All of which there has not been one person from in the United States that's ever perpetrated a terrorist attack from any one of those seven countries. There hasn't been.
But you know what I'm wondering is, why isn't Pakistan on the list?
Well, why is it? Look, Saudi Arabia, our best friend in the region, right? Saudi Arabia and Israel are our two best friends. All those people on those planes on 9/11 were Saudi Arabians. They were all Saudis. I mean, I'm exaggerating. Not every one of them was a Saudi, but the majority of them were Saudis. Osama bin Laden, who was, you know, enemy number one in America until he was taken out, he was a Saudi Arabian. I mean, I'm not sure the national origin is something that you can discriminate on and the basis of which you can discriminate against people. And, of course, the court has upheld that what the president has done is the executive order was not is not legal. So at least for now.
Well, the yesterday the temporary roadblock they're calling it last night.
Right, the temporary roadblock, which kept, by the way, a doctor who's practiced in the United States for years in quarantine in an airport, and two translators who helped us during the Iraq War. Mm-hmm. You know, so obviously, you know.
Well, there's going to, obviously, if when you do something that sweeping, there's going to be folks that get caught that shouldn't have been caught.
Well, that's true, and that's a relatively minor thing. But what's not so minor is that you have 16 attorney generals, 16 attorney generals. That's a third of all the attorney generals in America saying that, condemning the action, and including attorney generals of red states like Kansas. In addition to that, you've got world leaders coming out, England, France, Germany, Italy. They all said that they will not support the president in this action. So that's that you know, I find that very I find that a matter of great concern to me, that when our allies are starting to back away and the and people in red, you know, he's having as much problem. And this is the problem with doing something that sweeping, I think, is that he's having problems with people in his own party. I mean,
well, you know, it's funny because years ago I wanted to move to Europe. I had an idea that I could be like the boots on the ground for United States radio stations, so that when news was happening, I'd be there already and I could go to it and then be a reporter from there. Well, come to find out, I can only stay for 90 days. And if there was a European that could do the job that I was offering to do, then that person would get priority over me. And I learned that firsthand, that people do watch their borders and they do pay attention to who's doing what, where, and what have you. So I don't know why it's so wrong that we just want to make sure that we're tighter on our immigration standards.
Well, I don't think it's wrong to be tighter on, you know, to secure our borders. But let's not forget that there are people all over Europe that are indigenous Europeans. There aren't any in America except for those that are Native Americans. 99% of us are immigrants. We're a country of immigrants. So we have a history, and this is what bothers me about the wall. I think the wall is a bad international symbol, besides the fact that I think it's $2 billion that we might as well just set on fire, and because people will climb over it and cut through it. You live in Southern California. I know you've been in the Sonora Desert. I don't believe that anybody is going to go across 200 miles of Sonoran desert with a canteen of water and then get to a 30-foot wall and stop. They're not going to stop. It's not going to stop anybody. That's number one. And number two, it just sets a bad symbol, I think. I don't know how you feel.
Well, I don't know about a bad symbol, because whatever we're doing isn't working. And in my former broadcast life, I used to have a militiaman be a regular guest who was involved with protective services in some former capacity as a peace officer or a police officer or whatever. And then he moved to Arizona, and he was just disgusted by how many he saw coming over the border from Mexico on his property. And he would call me and talk about what was going on and where they were going and how they were living and how they were cohabitating and all this stuff. And he didn't know what to do. So this was a militiaman, if you will. Were they called Minuteman or something like that?
No, I don't remember.
If you recall back in the day. But in any regard, I got to hear from him firsthand what the flow of people. It was like nonstop all the time. Well, and your former co-host, Kathleen, talked about that with her experience in Arizona.
Right. And we've certainly had people from Kathleen's town. Her father was mayor of a border town. There's a lot of people from the border town. We've had several of them on the show, and I will tell you that people that live on the border in Arizona have a much different opinion on this issue than we do. You know, yeah. I have not. I'm sure there are people on both sides of the issue, but what I've heard, and I'm careful about using anecdotal, information to make decisions. But what I've heard from the people in border towns in Arizona is, yes, something needs to be done. That it's a terrible situation, and that's one of the things that really came out when we started to get into the stuff that I put on Facebook, is that several people that are from that part of the country wrote to me and said, look, we've got people coming over the border who are committing crimes, they shoot drugs over the wall, they do this, they do that. And I didn't have one person from a border town write to me and say, everything's okay down here. So there obviously something has to be done. But
well, Kathleen, as I recall, talked about that the hospital got shut down because they couldn't keep providing free services to the illegal immigrants.
Yeah, but you know, the one disagreement that we always had on that issue was that Kathleen saw it as a problem of illegal immigration. I never saw it as a problem of illegal immigration. I saw it as a problem of government, because Kathleen's hospital was required to take patients into their emergency room, you know, like most American hospitals, in fact, all American hospitals, I'm sure, they can't deny service to somebody that walks into an emergency room. But then the state refused to compensate her. Her hospital for those people. So they did go under, from my understanding, because they weren't compensated by the state. But that really is a government problem. It's not a problem, but would it be solved if we could secure the border? I don't know. Maybe it would be. I think we need to secure the borders. There's no doubt about that. And I think very few Americans disagree with that. They just want a liberal, I think, they want a liberal election policy.
What do you mean by that?
I think they want, a policy which, you know, we tend to put things into opposing categories like secure borders and open borders. I don't think that most Americans want no border security or want open borders, but I think they want a liberal program that allows people to come to America and work, that allows people that have been here to stay, to follow a path to legal
citizenship.
I think, you know, we all talk about how everybody came over here legally. I mean, that can't possibly be the case.
Well, my grandparents came through Ellis Island, so that
mine
has
too.
To be legal.
Yeah,
right?
Mine too. My grandparents came through Ellis Island too. But how many people came through Ellis Island? Not 200 million, you know, millions maybe, but a lot of us just showed up. And so I think that we have been a great light unto the world for refugees. And I think there's a sentiment in America with a lot of people, certainly not all, but a lot of people that want to continue that. And that's what bothers me. That's what I said about, the wall to begin with. I said, how can we go from give me your huddled masses yearning to be free to putting up a big keep out sign everywhere? How can we do that?
Well, or how about just let's play by the rules? We have rules in force.
Right. We
don't
have rules.
But we don't back them up. I guess that's really what the issue is.
Well, we don't.
It's not that we don't have a way to citizenship. I know plenty of folks. In fact, lots of students that I go to school with, that they're from other countries and they're here either on student visas or they've immigrated, but they're U.S. citizens.
Oh, absolutely. And I'm sure that there are many laws that need to be enforced better than they're being enforced. But that's not what this man is saying. You know, let's be straight about it. He said during his campaign that he wanted to ban all Muslims on the basis of their religion. And so now he goes forth, right? And he hasn't actually done that, but he goes forth with tying up people that hold green cards and are legally in our country. He's giving Christians a priority. What is that? He gives Christians a priority to come into the country? I'm a Christian, and I don't think that's right. But so he's generated these fears again. I think if he hadn't said those things during the campaign, people might not be as fearful of what's going on right now. But people are fearful because they're going, look, he said he was going to do it, and now he's doing it.
Well, and of course, there's checks and balances, and the judge that last night that made the ruling, that's part of it unfolding, right?
Yep. Yep.
So I guess I have faith in our system, because it's not there, you know, there's then the three branches of government. It's not just about our president. So he might rattle his sword or saber as much as he wants to, but then we have a process so that we don't have somebody who's just on the top dictating, or a dictatorship, if you will, right?
Right. Well, right. Absolutely. And you know, I have faith in our system, too, in the long run. I do. And I think that those opposing forces will, you know, balance each other out. But the thing that, again,
it's definitely going to push it, though, I'll have to admit.
Well, and the thing that gets me is, are we really going to balance things, or have we just reached a place of loggerheads where politically, where 50% of us are on one side and 50% of us are on the other, and we're just going to push each other so that nobody moves?
Well, the pendulum is swinging to the other direction, that's for sure. So how far it swings, we'll see. Because we had 8 years swinging left, and now we're swinging right, and we'll see how far right. So you want to talk about the March for Life on Friday?
Yeah, the March for Life.
So I'm curious what your defund Planned Parenthood. So should taxpayers pay for abortion and to abortion providers or not?
Well, I think they should, yes. I think that there is a federal ban. This, again, is more hyperbole. There's no federal money going to pay for abortions. There's a federal ban on it. Should Planned Parenthood, by the way, who only 3% of what they do is abortions, 97% of what they do is other healthcare stuff, should they be funded by the national government? Yes. And I believe, look, I know that I've had some right to life people tell me that I'm being wishy-washy or I'm copping out, because my feeling about it is that I don't have a right to tell a woman what to do with her own body. So it really becomes a non-issue for me as a male. You know, even in the case of my own children, I would say, you know, that if something was seriously wrong with one of my wife's pregnancies and she wanted to terminate it, I wouldn't have stood in her way. I really don't feel that that's my right. Thank God it's a decision that we never had to make. We never had to make that decision. You know, we had three beautiful children who all love their mother and are getting to like me more and more every day. Hopefully by the time they have children. That's all right. You know, that's why I'm hanging on, Maria. I'm just going to live long enough so that I can be a burden to them. And, you know, I just want to be able to walk in the living room and say to some little girl, here's your pony. Have fun and don't forget to keep it in the house. Tell mommy you can't let it out. You know, I live for that. But the truth of the matter is.
I get the feeling you've made that statement more than once.
Yes, I have. But, you know, the truth of the matter is that thank God we didn't need to
make well, that. And there, but for the grace of God go I as right. well. But right. I don't know that is something that taxpayers should fund. They say that 17 states have gone around that Hyde Amendment and have allowed women to use state funding to cover the cost of abortions. And yes, you're right, it's only 3% of their services. So it really won't affect their outreach if 3% of their funding is declined, if you will.
Well, but that's not what they're talking about, are they? And I mean, that's one of the things that bothers me. They're not talking about taking away 3% of their funding. They're talking about shutting them down. They're talking
they're prohibiting taxpayer funding from paying for abortions. It's specific.
Well,
the bill that passed the House on January 24th.
Well, I don't understand that, because there's already a federal ban. No federal money can be used for abortions, not a dime. And what has happened, you're right, states go around it, but that's states' rights.
17 of them.
Yes, they go around it, and that's their right. And the District of Columbia. But guess what? A really nice guy, Republican from Capitol Hill, has put forth legislation which would ban the District of Columbia. Now, the other 17 states could still use state money for abortions, because the federal government cannot ban the state from using its own money, but they can ban the District of Columbia, you know, who uses hardly any money for that. We use money for poor people, poor women who can't get abortions. You know, I went to jail for this. In 2009, I sat in front of the Senate. Yes. One time I've ever been in jail. 45 worst minutes of my life. Anyway, I sat in front of the Senate to block the Senate, because the Senate had legislation that they were trying to pass that said, that D.C. couldn't use its own money to do that. And we were the only jurisdiction in America where they could do that. Now, I will say, as much as I like President Obama, it was the one time that we came to a conflict with him over this, because Obama said to the Republicans on Capitol Hill, and unfortunately was overheard saying, "I'll give you abortion in D.C. if you pass the budget." And so we criticized him for what we felt was throwing us under the bus, because this is how it goes in D.C. The president gets to decide. Congress gets to decide. The only people that don't get to decide are us. So
I can't imagine how impotent that must make you feel at the end of the day. It's got to be terrible. I mean, you're adults. Citizens.
It does.
You pay. Now,
We pay through the nose. We pay the highest taxes in America. We serve it higher than the national average. You know, the guy that wrote the Star Spangled Banner was a D.C. resident who was out on a mission for the D.C. National Guard. We were called something else in those days. I think we were called a militia. But Francis Scott Key was a soldier from Washington, D.C. And the guy who wrote Taps, Butterworth, was a Congressional Medal of Honor recipient from the District of Columbia. We've been a part of America since America began. And you know what? Another thing that makes us feel impotent and pisses us off is when people say things like, you know, Washington has gotten wealthy on the backs of America. No, we haven't. You know who's gotten wealthy? The guys you send from California, Iowa, Michigan, Nevada. They're not people that live here. They're people that come here and run our politics. The people of District Columbia are just like you and everybody else. They're teachers, they're lawyers, they're doctors, they're people from all walks of life who want exactly the same thing that other Americans want.
So one way to solve that, I would imagine, is that you can live in the District of Columbia, but you claim statehood with the surrounding states.
Well,
like
that is
you
one
have
way.
Residency in Virginia, say, or you know, something that abuts you and adjoins you, because otherwise, I just can't imagine the taxes you pay. And it's like you're a child that is being told what to do
right.
by Big Daddy, who's in the office of the President of the United States.
Well, and also, you know, we don't have control over our own tax money, for example. So I often use that analogy. I call Washingtonians the national teenager, because we do have a city council that decides how to use the $9 billion, but then we have to go up to Capitol Hill to see if it's all right, because they can revoke everything. So I say, you know, it's like giving your kid who's going off to college a credit card, but saying, well, if you spend over $100, you got to call mom and dad and see if it's okay. And if we don't like what you're spending the money on, we're just going to cut you off.
Right.
And it's our money. It's not federal money that we're talking about. It's the money that we raise through real estate taxes and sales taxes and every other kind of tax. But this is, you know, this is our problem. And what's happened in the first month of the Congress is they've attacked our law, that the one that I went to jail. And by the way, I went to trial. I not only went to jail, I went to trial. And I just have to share this with you on the air. The judge at the end of the trial looked at me and said, "You are my hero." Me and a handful of other people there. "You are my hero because you stand up for the principles you believe in." And then he said, "But even heroes can't sit in the middle of the damn street and block traffic." And he whacked his gavel down and he said, "You're guilty. That's $100 fine." So it was kind of a mixed message there, you know, that you know, we could be heroes, but he needs to get home.
But you can't block traffic.
Right, you can't block traffic. And and you know, I've got to tell you, because when we sat in the street, of course, we sat there for a few minutes, and then the Capitol Police came and they closed down all traffic so we wouldn't get run over while they were arresting us, which took a while. And I just saw the look on the guy's face. As his car pulled up to us, I could see the look on his face like, "Oh my God, I can't believe that I made a left-hand turn and now I'm going to have to sit here for half an hour while they get these guys out of the street." Yeah.
Speaking of traffic, Michael, God rest in peace, Mary Tyler Moore, who passed away this
God
week at 80. Fresh Air, NPR, Terry Gross re-aired an interview that she did with her in 1995 when her autobiography was published. And that infamous take her beret off and throw it up into the sky segment that opened up her show in Minneapolis, she said in the interview that the director said, "Hey, I've got an idea. Why don't you do this? And we'll watch traffic." And that was literally in the middle of the street with traffic. That wasn't, staged or it was sanctioned or anything. And that made me think of that. She said, she barely was being missed by cars as she was turning around and tossing the beret up into the air. It was what a life she had.
Well, and I'm sure that director is so glad that he didn't get America's Sweetheart run over. And now I don't want to digress too much, but now that we're on the subject, I should tell you that one of the things I do, and which is my honor to do, is that I help judge the D.C. History Fair. And a few years ago, the theme was people that have changed America. Or people that have made changes. And one little girl did her project, an internet project, on Mary Tyler Moore, Lucille Ball, and I'm trying to think of who the third one was. Carol Burnett, and how they had changed the image, how they had changed the image of women and really had a dramatic impact, right? They had a dramatic impact on women's attitudes about work and all sorts of other things. And the really interesting part of this story is that she sent 20 questions to Carol Burnett, and Carol Burnett answered each one of them personally.
Aww.
Yeah.
Yay.
For a middle school student, from a middle school student from Washington, D.C. So, you know, we're really going to miss Mary
Tyler. She was laid to rest today in a private ceremony in Connecticut, Fairfield, Connecticut.
Well, you know, we all had a crush on Mary Richards. Well, most people had a crush on Mary Richards. I've always had a crush on Betty White, and I think that Sue Ann Nevins was the best character on that show. But she really did change the way we think about women, and God bless her. And we've lost a lot of people. Last week, I saw we lost the man that played Mannix and a couple of other actors and somebody that I followed for years, a guy named Butch Trucks, who was the original drummer with the Allman Brothers Band, one of my favorites. But so may they all rest in peace. And yeah. Mary Tyler Moore,
articles published this week that claimed that she was the greatest female television actress ever, which is saying a lot if you think about Lucille Ball and Carol Burnett.
Yeah, thank God Lucille Ball's not around to hear that, because my understanding is he had quite an ego and wouldn't have tolerated that too much. But yeah, she certainly was one of the greats, we sure will miss her in America.
Just wanted to mention, too, that on Friday, Seattle passed the first ever safe injection site for users of heroin and other injectable drugs. They're saying that that's necessary to address the epidemic of addiction. And I don't think we've ever seen anything like this in our lives with the opioid addiction, and they say it starts in the medicine cabinet.
Yeah.
That folks who are being prescribed things, and then people who are in the household that are taking it and then become addicted and then can't afford it. And so I guess heroin is pretty affordable or cheap or something.
Yeah, unfortunately these days it is. And you know what? I'm old enough to have buddies that went to Vietnam, and some of them came back with habits that they had to break.
Really?
Yeah, and it was really cheap in Vietnam too. The
poppies.
The scuttlebutt was that the North Vietnamese would send it into the South to be distributed among troops, and you know, very inexpensively, so that they, you know, because they felt the more people, more soldiers hooked on heroin, the better off their war effort would go. But it has become a real epidemic.
Well, they say it's killing more people than car accidents. And in 2015, heroin deaths surpassed the number of deaths from gun homicides.
That's terrible.
It's a lot.
It's a lot. But, you know, that leads us back to what we were just talking about in D.C. We had a ban. We had a needle exchange program that we tried to put into place. And the reason that we tried to put it into place is that D.C. had the highest new incidences of AIDS cases in America. And AID, you know.
You mean last year, 2016?
No. This was back in early 2000. We put a needle exchange program in our budget using our own money, because that's what the disease for
was
the
coming
center
from
for
was needle sharing.
Well, right, and not, that's what this, the center on disease.
Sex.
Well, the thing about unprotected sex as opposed to needles is you have unprotected sex, you can get AIDS. But you sit in a room with 15 junkies and they all pass around the needle, not one of them walks out with AIDS, 15 of them walk out with AIDS. So the Center for Disease Control said the best practices was to have a needle exchange program, which many places did. For 10 years in a row, the Congress took the money for the needle exchange program out of our budget, 10 years in a row. And it was only until 2 years ago when we did hit the highest rate of new AIDS cases in America that they allowed us to put it back in. And in that time, new AIDS cases have been reduced by 86%. So we really suffer under these laws. It's not, you know, some people say, well, if you don't like it, you know, big deal. You guys are rich and, you know, nobody feels sorry for D.C. But we do suffer. And besides the abortion ban, Marco Rubio has attacked our gun laws. He has put forth legislation that would make carry permits available in District of Columbia despite our regulations against them. We have to have a carry permit in Washington, D.C., you have to have a reason for it. And there's a list of reasons, you know, but he wants to end that, and he wants to end our ability to make our own gun laws in the District of Columbia. We'd be the only jurisdiction in America that would do that. And Jason Chaffetz, who's from Utah, has put together a call for a resolution in both houses to ban the fact that we have a death with dignity law that's just passed. And actually had an editorial in the Washington Post today against death with
against dignity. It?
Yes. He doesn't want a death with dignity law in the district, and he says that Congress is obligated to stop it because Congress controls the District of Columbia, which is what the Founding Fathers wanted. But we like to remind people that the Founding Fathers didn't want women to vote. They didn't want African Americans to vote.
Exactly.
They didn't want Native Americans to vote. They were not a really inclusive group of guys. Even
right.
though they came up with a really nice government and a really good system, they were scared. You know, this was America and democracy was a great experiment. So they didn't know how involvement in government, you know, how having people involved was going to affect things. So they kind of closed everybody out. But anyway, we're still fighting with that.
Because I just this week was tutored in the our death with dignity law, the state of California, that became legal in June of last year. And it really is, it's modeled a lot on what Oregon has done,
right.
And theirs has been in effect for almost 20 years.
Yeah.
They've never had one person violate the terms and conditions of it. And of the prescriptions that are given, about one third don't go through with it.
Right.
So we took lessons from them, and the one that we've got in effect here in California, it's called Compassionate. And it really is. It gives lots of choices. Of course, you have to be mentally stable, and you have to have two physicians that recommend, and there's X amount of days in between, and et cetera. And you must be able to self-administer, et cetera. So I can understand why somebody would choose that. And I wonder how the Catholic Church must weigh in against it, I would assume, don't you think?
I assume so, too, and I don't know. But look, I'm going to share something with you, and this is why people are listening to our show, because Maria has this ability to get you to say things that you wouldn't normally say, I think. And I'm going to tell you that the woman that raised me, that both my parents died when I was a kid, and my older sister raised me. First person in my family to go through college. She
became an attorney too, right?
Yes, became an attorney, partner in a law firm. And
died of breast cancer.
At 46 years old, and we went to the hospital, and you know, at the very end, and they said to me that she wanted to be in hospice. She wanted to be at home. And they said to me, you cannot take her home. We're not going to stand for this. And I said, well, I have no choice but to do this. This is a woman who's done everything for me in life, and this is the one thing she's asked me to do. And I actually had a chemotherapy nurse get hysterical and break down, sobbing, saying to me, you don't understand. Her death is going to be horrible, and you're not going to be able to deal with it. And I said to her, is there anything you can do in the hospital that I can't do at home? And she said to me, probably not, but whether you'll have the strength to do it or not is terrible. They thought my
sister. You mean the fortitude?
Yes. They thought my sister was going to suffocate to death because of the way the tumor was growing. So they said all this to my sister, of course, and my sister asked me to, if it came down to it, she wanted to die with dignity. She asked me to administer a lethal dose of drugs to her if that became you know, something that she felt needed to be done. Again, because God has always liked me, I guess. It never came to that. She passed peacefully at night. She didn't suffocate. The tumor didn't grow in the direction they thought it was going to grow. At one time, it was a third the size of her body. but it didn't grow around her lungs. It grew in a different direction. And luckily, it was a decision that I really never had to make. But I understand it, and I can tell you that if she had wanted me to do it in the end, I don't feel like I would have had any other choice. But
my understanding is, at least here in California, that hospice equips the family members with the cocktail that they need mm-hmm. to do to help hurry that along.
Well, that didn't happen.
It's not in writing. You know, I've just known too many people who had loved ones in hospice, and they said, yeah, we were told what to do. It turns out they didn't need to because the person had passed on on their own.
Well, and hospice is a great thing. They really
amazing. Amazing.
Amazing to say. Yeah, the strength.
And those are pure angels.
Yeah, they certainly are. I could go on for a week about how wonderful they were, and they knew exactly what they were doing. You know, I had two women that became part of my family through hospice, and the day they were there every day. They were with me every moment that I needed them.
Aww.
And the day that my sister passed away, I couldn't get in touch with either one of them. And if I would, when I would call for them, all I wanted to do was thank them. And I would call and they'd say, no, you tell us what you want to say and we'll tell them, because they understand what they're doing, and they understand that there's a time to be there and be supportive and be your, you know, whatever you need. And they understand there's a time to say goodbye and to move on, and for you to move on and for them to move on. So,
and by the way, here in California, if you do take advantage of that, the right to die, it's not considered a suicide or assisted suicide. Mm-hmm. And on the death certificate, it will give the whatever the prognosis was. That's how you succumbed, not that you took your own life, if you will. So it doesn't affect life insurance benefits. Here, I'm only speaking about California because I can't speak to other states, but we're the fifth state that has enacted an end of life option. And
there's several of them.
Passionate.
Yeah. And you know what? For me, again, I hope this isn't a cop out, but it doesn't even have to go that far for me. It's what the people of the District of Columbia wanted and voted for through their elected representatives. So I don't think that Congress should have a right to interfere with that. But, I guess we're going to look. We've almost run out of time here. We're going to have to end our discussion again. But next week, you know, we're going to have to carry it on, I think, because I can't get the one thing that bugged me most this week. And you can tell me what the greatest thing you think President Trump did. But the thing that bugged me most this week about him is that he can't get over the fact that he lost the popular vote. The man is president.
I know. Yeah, that is a little shortcoming of his, I would say.
Yeah.
He's yes, but he could announce as early as tomorrow his Supreme Court nominee.
I know, and we're all waiting to hear that.
And apparently, it's down to two. So those in the know say to Neil Gorsuch, however you say his name, or Thomas Hardiman. So that'll be interesting to finally have the full nine, because that they're limping along.
I know it's going to be it's going to be a battle. I don't think tomorrow, you're going to see anybody in the Senate standing up saying, "Oh yeah, we love this guy. Let's pass him," regardless of which one they choose. Although I understand that Gorsuch would be more acceptable for some reason to liberals. Because he's not as ideological, I guess. I don't know. But they're both conservative. And you can't expect them not to have a conservative.
Exactly.
Because that's what he campaigned on. But we're going to have to carry on this conversation for many weeks, folks. So stay out there listening. And I want to thank Maria, and thank you all for listening. And Maria, if you want the last word, we're going to play you out the show tonight with a song by the late, great Michael Jackson called Heal the World. But go ahead, Maria. Say goodbye.
Just want to thank everybody for your participation and your patriotism and your patience. Let the process unfold and have a great week.
Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote.